Not normal. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Another horrific school shooting. Another collective shrug of America's shoulders. This reporter says, wake up.
This is not normal. It does not happen in other comparable countries. It is a tragedy that America is living through, and it needs to get a grip on it.
Plus, I ask a former Homeland Security advisor if there's anything the U.S. can learn from other countries about gun control.
I mean, I don't think any one place has got it right, but we for sure have it wrong.
And later, this Buddhist monk wants to give artificial intelligence, or AI, an ethics lesson.
We would like to see AI to become more compassionate or altruistic. These are the two Buddhist concepts.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Again today, an American president stood before the nation and addressed the grief caused by a deadly school shooting.
To every parent, teacher, and child who is hurting so badly, we are here for you, whatever you need, whatever we can do to ease your pain.
One student who survived yesterday's shooting in Parkland, Florida, is David Hogg. Speaking to CNN, he had this pointed message for President Trump and others in Washington.
We're children. You guys, are the adults. You need to take some action and play a role. Work together, come over your politics, and get something done.
Get something done. There are many others around the globe thinking the same thing. A journalist I know in Lebanon tweeted this morning, overheard in Beirut. Things may be crazy here, but at least we don't have kids walking into schools and shooting other kids. Guns in these mass shootings are sadly very American. It's something we've talked a lot about on this show because there have been a lot of shootings. But Fran Townsend says we need a new mindset when we approach these tragedies. Townsend served as a Homeland Security and counterterrorism advisor to President George W. Bush.
We think of Homeland Security as being either terrorism or natural disasters. But even in the terrorism context, we, you know, have great concerns over lone wolf terrorists. And frankly, if you think about it, what happened in Florida, we've had, and all these school shootings, is you have an individual, oftentimes with mental health issues, sometimes angry, take a serious assault rifle into a school with the intent of inflicting mass casualty and instilling fear in children. And so I don't know how we don't classify that as domestic terrorism. And quite frankly, if the name of the shooter here was not Nicholas Cruz and it was a Muslim name, we'd all be hyperventilating and Republicans and Democrats in Washington would be holding hands about it. So I frankly think we have to be honest with ourselves. This is a form of domestic terrorism. The targets are children. And so we have to take it as seriously, if not more seriously, than we take every other form of terrorism. And that mentality shift doesn't seem to have happened in this country. And as you might tell, I'm frustrated about that.
Well, you were, as I said, at Homeland Security under George W. Bush, and that whole department was a result of 9/11 and preventing another 9/11. Are you saying that department needs to rethink its whole mission?
So I was at the White House as an advisor to President Bush, and I do think that it's part and parcel of the fundamental mission of the Department of Homeland Security. Children in this country can't vote, they can't write political contribution checks, and so they have no political or public policy voice. And unless this becomes a public movement where the public demands change, the entrenched interest in Washington and the money of lobbyists will continue the status quo, which is exactly what's happened after every other school shooting. I mean, just to give you some statistics, the three deadliest mass shootings in the United States in our history have all happened in the last 5 months. We have a public safety problem, and that goes to the heart of not just state and local law enforcement, but the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security, and the administration need to begin to deal with this as the sort of crisis that it is.
Fran Townsend, when you look around the globe, what can we learn from other countries?
I think we have to take a hard look again at the assault weapons ban. It was in place for many years. It expired here. It's a political lightning rod, but we know that this is sort of the weapon of choice in these mass shootings because of the capability of the weapon. This is a weapon that was really a weapon of war. It was meant for military use. And frankly, I think we need to have an honest conversation about why and whether we want civilians to be able to possess these weapons.
Are there countries you look at and say, aha, they got it right?
I think Senator Chris Murphy, who was on the floor of the Senate, who said, you know, this doesn't seem to happen anywhere else. Anywhere else. And so that's why I say to you, you have to look at across the spectrum, access to weapons. I mean, I don't think any one place has got it right, but we for sure have it wrong. Honestly, we protect nuclear weapons plants. We protect buildings. We protect all sorts of things in this country. It'd be nice if we turn our attention to protecting our children.
Fran Townsend, former Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor to President George W. Bush. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
This country is running out of superlatives to describe its frequent gun massacres. That's actually a quote from James Astill, who writes the Lexington column for The Economist. Welcome, James. Tell us what you mean by that.
The prevalence of these mass killings is now so extraordinarily pronounced. There are so many mass killings, including school shootings, such that Americans have just got sort of inured to them, and their news media has got inured to them. Many of these school shootings don't even get covered in national news outlets.
You've lived in the U.S. for a couple of years. I think that still counts as a fresh pair of eyes. So having been all over the world, James, including some years in India, what goes through your mind? What do you think when you see news like yesterday's shooting outside of Miami popping up in your newsfeed?
I find it beyond frustrating and enraging and tragic that America has reached this point of daily crisis in its schools, of course, on its streets, involving such a high degree of gun violence, and it has no political fix. Instead, we get this familiar cycle of repetition whereby the left immediately starts arguing for gun controls and the right immediately says, you know, we mustn't talk about any kind of policy action in the wake of this tragedy. It's disrespectful to the bereaved and the grieving. And then, of course, there is no serious policy discussion because the right is so invested in the status quo in having such free gun ownership in this country.
What is your basic analysis down there in Washington as to why each of these tragic episodes doesn't move the meter?
I think that the politics has become corrupted. I think that the vested interests, lobbying groups, many of them funded by gun manufacturers, have exerted such influence in the politics of the right, especially, not exclusively, but especially, that politicians don't have open minds on the issues. And I think that that Americans at large widely misunderstand the issues. There are all kinds of false dichotomies between responsible and irresponsible gun owners, between legal and illegal gun owners, suggesting that one is safe and one is dangerous, one is threatening, one's protective. By and large, these are unhelpful dichotomies. We know from evidence around the world that when you have more gun ownership, you get more gun violence,
right?
Whether it's gun suicides or it's gun murders. This is so clearly established from policy debates and then outcomes in other countries that it shouldn't really be an open question. America has so much gun violence because it has so many guns.
So the politics are corrupted. And it's interesting, The Economist's own global research arm, The Economist Intelligence Unit, just released its Democracy Index for the globe in the U.S., which, according to your matrix, was once a full democracy, just went through its second year as a flawed democracy. So once we were on par with New Zealand and Sweden, we're now on par with Italy and South Korea. How much does the U.S. gun and shooting problem have to do with that?
Well, I think that it's clearly connected to the role of money in American politics, which is arguably one of those corrupting influences. I think there's too much opacity. I think there's too much corporate influence as a result of both that opacity and just the astronomical costs of doing politics in America. So it's part of the problem.
James, do you have children?
I do. I have three children.
And I
resent bitterly and fear terribly when they come home from their local public school and tell me that they had to climb in and out of their cubbyholes today and that they had to practice being hushed on their teacher's command in case somebody bad comes into the school. This is not normal. It does not happen in other comparable countries. It is a tragedy that America is living through, and it needs to get a grip on it.
What do you tell them?
Do as you're told.
And after an event like this, do you have any words that can comfort them? I mean, I know people today who have taken their kids out of school. Their kids didn't want to go to school today.
This is not my tragedy. It's not my children's tragedy. So I'm in no way trying to infect this tragedy with my own emotions. But I would point out that it is not normal. It's not inevitable. It should not be necessary that children around this country are going through drills to protect them or to offer some vain hope of protection in case a lunatic walks into their school with a military assault rifle. It's crazy.
James Astill with The Economist, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are many things about the Parkland, Florida high school massacre that are depressingly familiar. One is the weapon used by the 19-year-old suspect, an AR-15, the same lightweight semi-automatic rifle used in so many other shootings from Newtown in 2013 and San Bernardino in 2015 to Las Vegas and Sutherland Springs, Texas last year. Local media in Florida report the suspect bought his gun legally. In Florida, there's no waiting period for would-be buyers of rifles or other long guns. The National Rifle Association has called the AR-15 the most popular rifle in America and estimates Americans own more than 8 million of them. The NRA says it's popular because it's, quote, customizable, adaptable, reliable, and accurate. Those features may also explain why it's also become a weapon of choice for mass shootings. Peter Squires follows all of this from across the Atlantic. He's a specialist in gun violence at the University of Brighton in England. He says the way the AR-15 has been marketed by Colt, its manufacturer, has added to its appeal.
On the one hand, a kind of propaganda of fear is encouraging people to buy and have available the next best firearm on the market. And a whole raft of characteristics claimed for the AR-15 that suggests that it is a tough and resilient gun and only a real man can handle this kind of firepower.
A standard AR-15 magazine holds 30 bullets, but in most states, including Florida, the rifles can be legally outfitted with high-capacity magazines that can hold more rounds. And the suspect in yesterday's shooting reportedly had multiple magazines when he surrendered to police. There are several U.S. states that have laws limiting or banning the sale of assault weapons. California, for example, has banned AR-15s and other rifles with detachable magazines, which allow shooters to quickly reload.
They are the types of weapons that are being most misused in the recent mass shootings. They enable people to kill a lot of other people very, very quickly.
Again, that's Peter Squires, who studies gun violence at the University of Brighton in England. And one more note about gun laws in this country. There was the 1994 assault weapons ban signed by President Clinton. It prevented the sale of certain military-style assault weapons for private citizens and set a limit on high-capacity magazines of no more than 10 bullets. But the ban only applied to new weapons, and it included a sunset provision, meaning Congress needed to reauthorize it, which it did not, so the ban expired in 2004. Coming up, a deep question. What can artificial intelligence learn from ancient, non-Western traditions like Buddhism? You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. When I interact with any technology, a computer or a smartphone, I try to invoke a little mindfulness. I try to work with the gadget, not against it. That's my decision. Let's flip that now and examine how our gadgets make decisions. Now, we're talking artificial intelligence. Think smart assistants like Alexa or Siri, or driverless cars. As these technologies get more sophisticated, we'll be relying on them more and more to make decisions on their own. But how can we make sure that when that time comes, they make the right decision, the ethically responsible decision? Yes, it is a complicated question, and there's not one single right answer. After all, how do we define what's right, ethical, or moral? Are we talking philosophy? And if so, is it Western philosophy? Well, that is one thing that people who work in the budding field of artificial intelligence ethics seem to agree on.
I think there is a domination of Western philosophy, so to speak, in AI ethics.
That's Pak Hung Wong. He's with the University of Hamburg in Germany, where he studies philosophy of technology and ethics.
By that, I mean when we look at AI ethics, most likely they are appealing to values in the Western philosophical traditions, such as value of freedom, autonomy, and so on.
Pak Hung Wong is part of a group of researchers who want to go beyond those Western philosophical traditions. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou has been speaking with several people involved with this effort and is in the studio with me now. So tell us more about this project that Pak Hong Wong is involved with, Lydia.
Yeah, so this is an effort that's being led by the engineering association, IEEE. What they did is they brought together a group of researchers to have them come up with more globally minded ethical standards. So looking beyond this Western scope that Pak Hong Wong mentioned. Now, before I go any further, I do want to say that, you know, when we say quote-unquote Western traditions, we're talking about thousands and thousands of years of philosophical thought, right? There are various streams of it. These researchers recognize that, and they're not saying that considering these Western foundations is inherently bad. What they are saying is that not considering other ethics traditions, like Eastern ones, for example, that could be very problematic.
So give us an example of how we might approach an AI dilemma differently. Like, do you have an example where we can compare the framework of Western ethics to Eastern ethics?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example that Pak Hong Wong gave me. Imagine a scenario where we're at a point where we have technologies that can just take a quick look at us and diagnose all our medical problems. If we use Western ethics as a guide, the stress in designing that technology would be, how do we make sure that if this system picks up that you have, say, a terminal illness, that that data is not shared with anyone except you, that data is protected? But Pak Hong Wong told me that that wouldn't be the case if we used Eastern ethics as our guide here.
The stress would not so much be on patients as an individuals, but to take the entirely family unit as a whole. It would disclose the information to the entire family.
So, Lydia, painting with a broad brush here, but for the sake of not getting too deep into the weeds, is this focus on the individual versus the community one of the big differences between East and West?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's one more thing we can take away from this example that Pak Hong Wong gave me. He said that in Western ethics, we tend to focus a lot on the restrictions that we might set in place to prevent bad things from happening when it comes to these technologies. But if we look to Eastern ethics, the focus would be embedding values from the different traditions that, you know, Eastern ethics are rooted in.
So it's rather different from the Western traditions in the sense that it is not about setting up a particular principles of restrictions, but rather you should try to build certain things to guide the technology along the way.
So whereas in Western thinking, we might add kind of layers of rules to make sure certain principles are upheld in this technological space, the thinking here is to identify the values that might guide the technology, right?
That's right.
So give us an example of these values that Eastern ethics emphasize that these researchers want to see more prominently in this discussion on AI.
Yeah, so I also spoke with someone who is, you know, an expert in Buddhism. His name is Saraj Hongladaram, and he teaches philosophy at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok, Thailand.
We would like to see AI to become more compassionate or altruistic. These are the two Buddhist concepts. It could be, you know, totally altruistic and willing to sacrifice itself.
Totally altruistic and willing to sacrifice itself. So maybe like a driverless car that if it crashes is willing to destroy itself instead of the passenger inside or a pedestrian. I know that's kind of out there as an example, but is
That is a good example. And, you know, I don't think you'd find any strands of moral philosophy that would guide the technology to do the opposite. But what Saraj Hongladaram told me is that the framing is really important here.
In putting in the Buddhist perspective, the idea is that more people around the world, especially those who are Buddhists, would be more accepting toward these guidelines for the AI system.
And Marco, if you can bear with me for just another minute, I want to give you just one more example of an African tradition that came up in this discussion.
What's the African tradition?
Yeah, so let's go to Rachel Fisher. She's with the African Center of Excellence for Information Ethics in South Africa. And she told me about the sub-Saharan philosophical tradition of Ubuntu.
Ubuntu means a person is a person through other people. Ubuntu is actually saying that we do not work as islands. We have to work together in a community because in the end, sharing is caring.
Sharing is caring. I mean, that sounds nice, Lydia, but how does this actually apply to this discussion of AI?
Right. So You know, Marco, the field of AI, it's a really fast-moving one. It's a lucrative one. And what Rachel Fisher told me is that if we use Ubuntu as a guiding principle here, we can make sure that the focus stays not on the individuals developing these technologies, not on the companies, you know, making the latest developments, but on the communities this technology might end up in.
Yeah, so what is next for these researchers, Lydia? Are they hoping to kind of set a global set of standards for AI? Is that even possible?
They did put this, you know, is this possible question to Jared Bielby, who heads this group of researchers.
We're not providing black and white answers. We're providing standards as a starting place. And then from there, it may be a matter of each tradition, each culture, different governments establishing their own creation based on the standards that we are providing.
And, you know, another big question, Marco, that we didn't get into is how do we make sure that as we do all this work, we don't unwittingly implant our own biases as humans into this technology? Because that, too, could be really dangerous. And that's another big question that researchers are grappling with.
Really fascinating stuff. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou, thanks very much for sharing what you found.
Thank you, Marco.
Tomorrow on The World, concern about cameras used by law enforcement to read the numbers on license plates. At least one of the companies that collects the data now has an agreement with immigration officials. It's not exactly Big Brother.
But it really is this sort of nationwide surveillance network that's been built up privately outside of the reach of a lot of the safeguards that would normally exist if ICE had built this database itself.
And at least one sanctuary city is concerned about its license plate readers and the company that collects the data.
They have assured us they didn't share any of our data. However, we are going to want to ensure moving forward as much as possible that it's not shared.
Privacy, public safety, and ICE. That's on tomorrow's show. I'm Marco Werman. Mary Catherine Nagel is both a playwright and an attorney, both in service to the Cherokee Nation.
Our tribal nations have an inherent right to protect our citizens, just like the United States has an inherent right to protect its citizens when they are the victims of crimes on their own lands.
Nagel's play, Sovereignty, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. South Africa has a new president. Cyril Ramaphosa was sworn in today, and he began his tenure by promising to root out the very thing that brought his predecessor down, corruption. Former President Jacob Zuma resigned last night. Here's more from my BBC colleague, Fergal Keane.
The moment of decision came late, when the former guerrilla fighter at last recognized he could not win. President Jacob Zuma addressed the South African nation and faced reality. I was just yards from him when he said the decisive words.
The ANC should never be divided in my name. I have therefore come to the decision to resign as President of the Republic with immediate effect.
And with that statement, Jacob Zuma has brought to an end the most controversial period in the history of post-apartheid South Africa. History happening in a late-night statement, after a day in which it seemed he might still fight on. In Pretoria, seat of the presidency, rumours of an imminent resignation had rippled all afternoon. Yet when he made his first appearance of the day on state television, he was defiant and defensive. Zuma, the victim.
What have I done? Because I've explained many times that this process, there's nothing I've done wrong. This is policy. What people are suggesting is a new thing, a new phenomenon. What is the problem?
At the same time in Cape Town, ANC MPs were meeting to decide whether they'd support a motion of no confidence to drive Jacob Zuma from power. The decision came quickly and was decisive. A populist, a crowd pleaser, he appealed to the ANC grassroots and with their backing became party leader in 2009. Even though he already faced serious corruption charges. I interviewed him just as he was about to become state president.
A lot of people think you're a crook.
Is that so? I want to see those people. Like, I must tell me why they
are. Are you a crook?
Me? Well, I don't know. Unless I must go to the dictionary and learn what a crook is.
It was his relationship with the Guptas, Indian immigrants, which created the public outrage that finally forced the ANC to act. The Guptas are accused of using their connections with the president to acquire state enterprises and assets worth millions of pounds. So powerful, it's alleged, they could hire and fire cabinet ministers. Today, they too felt the pressure. Seemingly untouchable until now, criminal charges may be imminent. By the end of this dramatic day, Jacob Zuma seemed friendless and politically isolated, resigning before he could be humiliated in Parliament.
The BBC's Fergal Keane there, reporting from South Africa. Arena Stage in Washington is putting on a series of political and historical plays, and the one that's running right now is the first in the series, written by a Native American. She is Mary Catherine Nagel, a Cherokee playwright and attorney. The play is called Sovereignty, and it features a young lawyer who may sound a lot like Nagel herself, but is not.
The character is definitely not autobiographical, but I will say very much inspired by the work I do as a full-time attorney, and certainly a lot of the issues that she fights for in the play are issues that my law firm deals with every day on a regular basis.
As the name of the play implies, those issues are all about sovereignty, specifically how the United States historically has sought to limit the Cherokee Nation's sovereignty over its own territory, and how the courts have dealt with that, both in the past and in more recent times. Part of the play, for example, focuses on a very current issue, tribal jurisdiction over crimes of violence against women. More on that in a moment. First to the other part of the play, where Nagel takes her audience back to the late 1820s and early 1830s.
The state of Georgia started passing a series of laws outlawing Cherokee Nation's sovereign government, making it illegal for Cherokee Nation's government to meet and pass resolutions and create laws. Outlawed any American citizen from entering Cherokee lands. And so if an American citizen entered Cherokee lands, the state of Georgia would come onto Cherokee lands and arrest that American citizen. And that is the story of a reverend by the name of Samuel Wooster, who is a character in the play. And because the play follows the past and the present, and then they collide at the end of the play. So here is Georgia trying to exercise criminal jurisdiction over an American citizen on Cherokee lands. And Cherokee Nation and Samuel Wooster took it all the way to the Supreme Court. And Georgia's argument was, well, tribal nations can't exercise criminal jurisdiction over American citizens on tribal lands. And Cherokee Nation's argument was, we're the only sovereign who can exercise criminal jurisdiction over anyone on Cherokee lands. And Cherokee Nation won. And Justice Marshall wrote this incredible opinion in Wooster, where he actually went through all of the different treaties that the United States had signed with Cherokee Nation and said, the United States calls Cherokee Nation a nation in these treaties. And these treaties are the supreme law of the land. And they protect and uphold and preserve Cherokee Nation's jurisdiction over Cherokee lands. And so that's it, you know, end of legal analysis right then and there. And the tragedy of that victory in 1832 is that President Andrew Jackson at the time refused to enforce it. So imagine if President Eisenhower said, that's really nice that the Supreme Court issued its decision in Brown v. Board of Education, but I don't have to enforce that, you know, tell the Chief Justice that he wrote his opinion, he can enforce it. And that is literally what Andrew Jackson said to John Marshall after the decision in Wooster.
Wow. Also tied into your narrative of sovereignty is kind of a thread built around the Violence Against Women Act. I mean, it's a legal and theatrical work. How does it relate to the Violence Against Women Act and its effect on tribal sovereignty?
Well, the play, you know, starts with Cherokee Nation implementing the Violence Against Women Act. And, you know, in 2013, the Violence Against Women Act restored tribal criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians who commit crimes of domestic violence, dating violence, and violation of protection orders. So to be clear, if the crime committed on tribal lands by a non-Indian and it's not one of those three crimes, then tribal nations do not have jurisdiction to prosecute. So, for instance, in the Dollar General case, the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians could not criminally prosecute the non-Indian perpetrator who sexually assaulted the Indian child in the Dollar General store, one of the Dollar General employees, because that wasn't dating violence, domestic violence, or the violation of a protection order. It was, you know, sexual assault in a workplace, and so not domestic. And that's a huge gaping hole that we have. But at the same time, we have a lot of attorneys in Indian country working really hard to make sure that all of our laws on the books stand up to the strictest scrutiny, because we know at some point a non-Indian who is prosecuted in a tribal court is going to take this case to the United States Supreme Court and argue, as the attorney that represented Dollar General in the Supreme Court argued in December 2015, that any tribal jurisdiction over a non-Indian is unconstitutional. So that's the argument we're preparing for. And that's the, the argument that Sarah Rich Polson, the main character, is up against in Sovereignty.
So your play is set in the 1830s and today. What do you want us, your audience, to connect from the 1830s to today?
Gosh, that we are still here and that we have an inherent right. Our tribal nations have an inherent right to protect our citizens, just like the United States has an inherent right to protect its citizens when they are the victims of crimes on their own lands. And I hope that non-Native Americans will also see us as human. I think, it's no coincidence that this is the first Native play to be produced at Arena Stage, and most theaters in the United States have never produced a single play by a Native playwright. And so most Americans, their only encounter with Native Americans is the back of a football jersey, and that's not even a real Native American, right? So we have a lot of work to do to rehumanize ourselves, and there are so many talented writers out there working right now, and hopefully other theaters will decide to produce Native plays as well.
Mary Catherine Nagel is an attorney who has written several plays, including Sovereignty, which is showing at the Arena Stage in Washington through this weekend. Mary Catherine, thanks very much for being with us. Great to meet you.
Great to meet you. Thank you so much.
Let me take you back now a few years to this pivotal moment for American craft beers at Oktoberfest in Munich.
And they announced the gold medal for the best Oktoberfest in the world went to Samuel Adams Oktoberfest. The air went out of the room.
That's Jim Cook, the man behind Sam Adams, speaking back in 2012. At the time, more and more European beer drinkers were trying out the bold, often hoppy experiments coming from American craft breweries. But since then, American craft beer exports have hit a lull. As part of our 50 States project, we sent the world's Jason Margolis to Colorado, home to some of the country's largest craft breweries, to find out what's going on.
At the New Belgium Brewing Company in Fort Collins, Colorado, Jesse Clays shows me around the bottling hall. Their Belgian-style signature beer, Fat Tire, has become one of the most popular craft beers in the U.S.
We're the fourth largest craft brewer in the country, as judged by annual barrel production. We were founded in 1991 in the basement of a Fort Collins home just a mile away from here.
Can you tell me, how many countries do you export to?
Well, that'd be a really good question for Casey to answer.
Currently, we export to Canada, Australia, Japan, South Korea, and Sweden, and Norway.
That's Casey Colheed. She manages export markets for New Belgium. She says their foreign sales remain small, less than 5% of their business. But she says she gets frequent requests from across the globe.
You name it, they've probably reached out. I mean, even United Arab Emirates, I hear from them a lot. All of Europe, South Africa, Brazil.
What she
Taiwan,
said next
Cambodia,
took me by surprise. She tells potential customers thanks, but no thanks.
I say what an honor and thank you so much for wanting our beer and reaching out. It's always, it just feels like an honor.
But why turn business away, especially if your job is to grow exports? Colheed says they need to take it slow and get things right. The fact is, it's expensive to ship a heavy liquid overseas, and logistically, tricky.
The biggest challenge is quality. Our beer tastes best, all beer tastes best fresh. So you've already got time against you going across the ocean.
That beer needs to be refrigerated throughout the entire journey. Colheed says shipping overseas adds about 75% to their costs. So a six-pack of Fat Tire that sells for $10 in Denver could easily cost $18 in Stockholm. You gotta do it the right way, though. If a beer drinker in Oslo or Tokyo picks up a less-than-fresh Fat Tire, there goes a potential customer for life. American craft brewers have a few other hurdles to overcome these days.
One is that the dollar isn't necessarily as in a favorable position.
That's beer economist Bart Watson with the Brewers Association in Boulder, Colorado. A stronger dollar is making American beer more expensive overseas. Second challenge, there's just more competition.
We've started to see the same explosion in breweries in other countries that we saw here in the United States. And so suddenly there are a lot of fuller flavored options in many of the markets that U.S. brewers were exporting into.
Then there's this perennial challenge. How do you get noticed in a new market? Again, Casey Colheed.
You know, if I knew the perfect answer to this question, we'd be gazillionaires probably.
A few American craft brewers have cracked the export code. Brooklyn Brewery, best known for its amber lager, is among the largest craft beer exporters. Roughly half of its revenue now comes from exports. Eric Ottaway, the company's CEO, says they've been able to grow overseas because they were early entrants, so they got a leg up on the competition. And they found a cheaper way to transport their beer. Most exporters ship bottles, cans, and kegs. Brooklyn began shipping beer in huge tanks.
It's kind of like a giant keg. You know, it's fully finished beer, fully carbonated, that sits in an insulated tank. Drink the beer right off the tank, actually.
Wow. How many kegs could fit in that?
It's 25,000 liters. It's like 420 kegs.
Shipping in a tank saves packaging weight and, in turn, costs. Ottaway says the other key to Brooklyn's export growth has been partnerships with local brewers to make and distribute their beer.
We work quite closely with Carlsberg throughout most of Europe. We're working with Kirin in Japan, Cooper's in Australia.
Back in Colorado, Casey Colheed with New Belgium says she admires Brooklyn for finding new ways to tackle international markets. New Belgium is also exploring partnerships with foreign brewers. But Colheed says that carries some risk.
It's strange that consumers all of a sudden change their mind about your beer if someone else is brewing it. And it no longer becomes an authentic American imported craft. It's brewed down the road. And so we've seen some other breweries falter because of they chose to do that. And they're viewed differently in the marketplace now.
Kona beer, the one with the hula dancers on the label, not brewed in Hawaii. The iconic Jamaican Red Stripe beer, that was being brewed in Pennsylvania for a while. Both beers faced some serious blowback and lawsuits from customers who felt duped. Eric Ottaway with Brooklyn says they haven't had many problems, except there were a few Australians who tried a Brooklyn beer brewed in Australia, then said, hey, this beer tastes different.
My response was, well, yeah, now it tastes like it actually should, as opposed to beer that's been sitting on the water for 6 weeks.
Add it all up, for beer drinkers in Sydney or London or Bangkok who really want an authentic American craft beer straight from the source, for now, they're going to have to pay a premium. For The World, Jason Margolis, Fort Collins, Colorado.
There is a new source of relatively cheap, low-carbon energy on the horizon, literally. It's offshore wind power. Not long ago, it was super expensive, but a big push in the UK has brought the cost way down, and that's making it a lot more likely that we'll see offshore wind power start to take root here in the US. But if offshore wind has a lot of new fans, fishermen are generally not among them. From our Livable Planet desk, here's Chris Bentley with the final installment in a series on the UK's offshore wind boom.
Steve Barrett is on the deck of the Razorbill, his fishing boat in the English port of Ramsgate. He's running thousands of feet of nets through a squeaky pulley, getting ready to set sail.
There's one I missed.
He snags a fish still stuck in one of the nets from last night and tosses it to the side.
That's a diver's soul, so that'll be my dinner later.
Barrett will head out tonight in search of more sole and other fish. And on his way, he'll pass right through a relatively new feature on the water here, the Thanet Wind Farm, 100 turbines visible from shore that have been spinning since 2010.
And for some reason, I don't know why, I don't know if it's the sound, the humming, the motors, I don't know what it is, but the fish are not in the wind farm.
Barrett says the area used to be a prime fishing ground, just offshore.
And now it's virtually barren, apart from a few whelks and a few lobsters.
Now, he says, he'll have to steam for 3 hours to get a good catch, almost all the way to the Netherlands. Barrett is not fond of the wind farm, and he's not alone.
You think to yourself, well, it never happened. Then reality kicks in, and it does.
John Nichols is standing on a bluff in Broadstairs, just up the road from Ramsgate, overlooking where the English Channel meets the North Sea. You can just barely make out the coast of France on the horizon. And much closer, the Thanet Wind Farm. Nichols used to fish out of Broadstairs. He's retired now, and he chairs the Thanet Fishermen's Association.
And here we are, with a wind farm that we don't particularly want. If we had a choice as a fishing industry, we would say no to it, even today. But it's there, and we have to learn to live with it.
Fishing here has always been a tough business. But Nichols says it's getting much tougher, and that the fleet here is just half of what it was 25 years ago. It's not just the wind farm, he says, or the others popping up around here as part of the UK's boom in offshore wind power. The sea in this part of England is also getting crowded with things like undersea cables connecting the UK and Europe. Then there are the effects of climate change.
We're also seeing a massive increase in water temperature here, and we're not seeing the hard northeasterly and easterly winds that we used to see.
Both of those changes could be affecting fish habitat here. Still, Nichols believes the wind farms are part of the problem.
Even if we did have a real hard easterly breeze now, it wouldn't filter through like it used to because of all the turbines. They act as a breakwater at sea.
Fishermen here say that's altered the seafloor and the tides. Just one more problem stacked on top of lots of others. But what fishermen say they're seeing, there's actually no way to know for sure if the wind farm is responsible. That's because by all accounts, there's been almost no research done on fish populations in the area, either before the turbines went in or since. Where those kinds of studies have been done, it seems the impacts have been small.
In most cases, it's been short-term.
Helen Bailey is a professor at the University of Maryland who studied the effects of other offshore wind farms in the UK and elsewhere. She says the biggest impacts are during construction.
The process that has been of most concern is the pile driving, which is when they hammer the foundation of the turbine to the sea floor, and that emits very, very loud sounds, and sounds travel very far underwater.
Bailey says all that noise tends to drive away marine species. But she says they tend to come back just a few days later. And she says in some cases, marine creatures seem to thrive around the new turbines.
They've now had examples where they actually saw seals feeding at the turbine sites. So these seem to be acting presumably like artificial reefs and actually attracting them to the area.
But offshore wind farms are a pretty new thing. And Bailey says scientists haven't properly studied what happens long term, or what the cumulative effects might be as more and more of them get built along the coast of the UK and elsewhere. For now, though, if some marine creatures are learning to adapt, some fishermen here are too.
I've got used to it.
Jason Parrott used to fish out of Ramsgate with his wife for Dover Sole. He still works on the sea here, but he's got a new job, ferrying maintenance technicians out to the wind turbines.
If you ask me whether I love it, I couldn't answer that. Not like I used to love the fishing, but it pays the bills and it's enjoyable.
Others here have taken advantage of a fund set up to compensate for lost fishing days due to construction at sea. The Thanet Fishermen's Association spent some of that money on a marine fueling pump.
We're like a service station on the motorway, you know.
Tom Brown is a retired fisherman. Ironically, he says the biggest customers are those maintenance boats for the wind farms.
So they'll come in here, fill up with fuel, and away they go again. And so the fishermen get a little payment from the wind farms and all the others.
I'll just do a sign again with this one.
For his part, Steve Barrett, back at the harbor in Ramsgate, is still sticking it out, just fishing, and trying to take all the changes here in stride.
I mean, if somebody said to me 20 years ago, over half of these fishing boats are going to be gone, and there's going to be 15 or 20 big catamarans servicing wind farms off here, I'd have said, yeah, all right, and laughed. And look what's happened.
Barrett's nearing retirement age. And until then, he says he'll keep steaming the razorbill through those wind farms to find fish. For The World, Chris Bentley, Ramsgate, England.
Chris's reporting was supported by a grant from the Heinrich Böll Foundation. You can catch his entire series on the offshore wind boom in the UK at PRI.org. Maybe you remember these sounds. They still haunt me. That's how we opened the show on November 17th last year, not long after another mass shooting here in the U.S., That day, we devoted the entire hour to gun culture across the globe. And those piano notes, they were the sound of mass shootings in America. The World's Sophie Chow took the data on mass shootings in the U.S. from January 1st, 2017 to early November of last year and represented it sonically. The notes happen in chronological order, and the louder the note, the more fatalities on that particular day. The last note we heard there represented the 26 people shot dead on November 5th last year inside a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. Today, after yet another mass shooting, Sophie updated the timeline. This time, it starts with Sutherland Springs. And the final note you'll hear represents yesterday's attack at that school in Florida. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.